So where am I? Trying to provide some sort of definition of imagination so that we can better understand how it plays out.
May I ask you about, this is just when you finish before the break, about the imagination and fancy.
The imagination?
And fancy.
Fancy, right.
So, me not being as versed in words of color, Jack, you're pronouncing the word fantasy in some kind
no,
of
way. No, no. Yes, in a way it's the difference between fancy and imagination. Yes, so a fantasy is merely the organisation of the elements of your experience in a sort of an assemblage which meets your expectations, desires or fears, if you see what I mean. So... And the best way you can tell the difference is the feeling. So with a fantasy, you feel, of course, if the fantasy is of some sort of fulfillment, you feel a certain excitement, which then becomes frustration or longing. If it's a fantasy that conjures up your fears, then you feel frightened and nervous and so forth and so on. If it's if the images that come into your mind are truly imagination in this sense, you will feel inspired. You will feel uplifted or fascinated. You can see it most easily with film. I've been investigating film a bit recently. My goodness, a bit late in the day, isn't it? After talkies, after silence. Anyway. I've been really interested in examining the effect on me and on my friends of the films that we see. And what I find really interesting is that often a film can be really engaging and people will even say, gosh, that was a good film, but you're left with nothing. You're even left a bit churned up. Then you see another film and... you may not even really know what it was about. I know the famous one, the favourite one for me is Tarkovsky's Mirror. You know, you can see it again and again, but you can never really work out what it's about. Because he's not interested in abouts. He's interested in what he calls the logic of images. So you come out of it in a quite different state of mind. Yes, the world looks different. So the key difference between imagination and fantasy... and therefore fancy, is to be seen in its effect. What aesthetic effect does it have? Does it merely have a psychological effect in the sense of playing to your egoistic desires? Or does it have an effect of uplifting? Of course it may be uplifting in the sense of making you deeply sad, if you see what I mean, for the real suffering that there is, or whatever. But does it have an effect that goes beyond you as an individual? So that's the sort of key way to say. So when you're sitting in meditation, just because you're producing image after image after image, doesn't necessarily have anything to do with imagination. And if you're sitting in meditation and your mind slips off the subject of meditation and produces a very powerful image, you're not necessarily doing something wrong, if you see what I mean. You can analyse it in terms of the forces that are creating the image, or you can analyse it in terms of the effects of the image. But I think it's most helpful. You know it most easily by the effects, and that's what one needs to try to do: to sit down and say, well, you know, did that train of thought, did that succession of images, what was that doing? What happened to me? Where am I left with it? And you may have to say, I don't know, but it feels better. That's fair enough. Yeah? Good. Priyananda.
You're using the term imagination, and Bhante, following Coleridge, uses the term imaginal. I understand that the imaginal has a very particular meaning for Coleridge, but you're using imagination in imagine in
interchangeably, yeah. Yeah. I may actually decide, after discussing with Bante, when I've written this up, I may change all the imaginations to imaginal, because it's so easy with technology. Or every other one or something like that. No, I may use imaginal, just to make it absolutely clear that one is not talking about Indian English, for instance, would just think of as fantasy. Yeah. So I may use imaginal. Coleridge uses both, by the way. And his primary distinction is between imagination and fancy. But he uses imaginal when he talks of, uses it as an adjective. So he talks about the imaginal faculty. And Bante, I think, probably favours that usage just to make it much clearer. In a way, what I'm aware of, I was thinking, reflecting back on the morning, because I found it very exciting, but also slightly nervous, because I'm sort of conscious that I'm not fully in control of what I'm talking about, which shows it must be imagination. And, you know, I'm not really quite able to deal with all the questions that are coming, and so on. But what I realised was, of course, it's because we don't talk about all this enough, and we need to create a language amongst us that takes all this into consideration. I'm sure that there are those who do talk about it, but I think it needs to be, we need to develop a culture within which there's a much richer conception of what awareness is. And I think it's a very, very good way in. I was talking to Vajra Devi because, you know, she's very interested in the subject of mindfulness, as we all are, of course. And I've been reflecting that the way mindfulness gets used, it seems such a sort of cold and narrow thing so often when people talk about it. And particularly when it's used in a therapeutic context, which I don't say is without great use. But I think introducing the notion of imagination into the conception of mindfulness gives a much, much vaster and richer field. So it may be that imaginal is a better way of speaking, just to make it clear.
I mean, follows on from what you're saying about having a language to talk about this. You gave a series of talks in the late 1990s, I think, where you talked about Shraddha as a faculty in us, which responds to the truth, responds to the beauty, responds to the good in others. And I mean, that's stuck in my mind ever since, and I find that kind of language very useful
What you could say is that once the mind begins to function in a more integrated way, it is responsive. It becomes intersubjective or transsubjective. One finds this this nature of the mind at work in many different fields. Empathy is an aspect of imagination. So at that time I was trying to explicate Bante's ideas about imagination by linking them with the term Shraddha. But of course Shraddha is so specific that it doesn't sort of go broad enough. So I would say that nowadays I'd suggest that to use the term imagination or the imaginal faculty as the all-inclusive term, which would cover response to nature, response to a friend, a real response to a friend, the response of empathy, the response to beauty, and no doubt the response to truth. When you hear the truth, it's not a necessarily a merely conceptual response, as it were. It goes there, you feel it. Yes, that's true. So at that time I was sort of trying to explicate what Bante had said, particularly in 1981 or 2, in those terms. But it was definitely the same stream of thought. So I would include Shraddha under the heading of imagination, or imagination under the heading of Shraddha, if you like. But it's this capacity of the mind, once it's functioning in a more integrated way, to put it that way, an uplifted way, it becomes responsive. It ceases to separate. It ceases to make exclusive boundaries. it ceases to function according to the laws of thought. A can be A and not A at the same time. Something can mean many different things. It's the capacity of the mind, let's put it that way, to use another metaphorical way of talking. I find the language of mind becomes too mechanistic. I like imagination because it lifts it right out of the psychological. It evokes the aesthetic field very easily. I think it's a more useful metaphorical location, if you see what I mean. But there are endless possibilities and endless connections. It's this capacity of the mind to break down barriers, to unite, to unify, to find deeper and deeper meaning. It's dynamic. One of the features of the imagination is very, very important. It has a self-transcending momentum within it, of its nature. Well, I think that often with Bhante, you have to be careful about how you put things. You need to explain very carefully what you mean. Because I must say, for the first time, somebody explained to me what they meant by it, and I got it. As before, I've always thought it's always been presented in terms of everything's interconnected with everything else, which is either so obvious as to be trivial, or so untrue as to be untrue. If what you mean by interconnected is that things affect each other, that's very, very important. This takes me. Maybe I will take this theme up, although I haven't concluded talking about what imagination is. Now, can I come back to that? Because I need to say something about Bhante's particular views on Mahayana, which are favourable, but they're as always nuanced. If you see what I mean. So he would be. Cautious of some realms of Mahayana philosophy, but very keen on the overall feeling and flavour of it, which he feels fills out and amplifies in a way that's not found in the original teachings. So we'll come back to that. Yes.
While you were talking about the imaginal world and imagination, you provided quite a good sort of way of looking at it for individuals, in terms of an individual deciding what's fantasy and what's imagination. But the way Bhante talks about it, for example, in the religion of art, is he gives it a much more objective flavour, as if art transmits spiritual value in an objective sense, which is true for, as it were, the whole of humanity. Mm. And one of the great difficulties all the time, I feel, is, well, how do we kind of actually reach that objective view of a sense of aesthetic spiritual value? Because just clearly by looking in the order, for example, one person sees is something...
Can we hold on that one? Because we're going into one of the fields that I'm going to explore in greater depth, if you see what I mean. It's part of the problem that you're all getting sparked off and not in a tidy, orderly manner. So if you wouldn't mind holding on that, because I think it's a bit difficult for everybody to keep the thread.
Yeah.
So if I can just finish explicating the imagination. So I would ask you to confine yourselves to questions that were related to what I've been directly addressing. Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, I was wondering, would need to be expressing itself in some way, in an external way, in the person's mind. Or, do you see what I mean? Because there are acts of mind, body, and speech. So,
yeah. Well, it depends on what level it's expressing itself, doesn't it? So that you may have an imaginative experience, as it were, which goes no further. Or you may have an imaginative experience that expresses itself in some creative act or speech. Or you may have an imaginative experience or a prolonged sequence of imaginative experience that become your life. So I think it depends on exactly what one's talking about. But yes, you may have a very strong experience in meditation of imagination, which you don't do anything with, and that's fine. I mean, in the practical sense, but it will change you if it's genuinely imaginative.
I was just really interested on the other weekend, Bhante was talking about magic, and it caught my interest in a way that the word imagination really doesn't. But I think he's talking about the same thing, I think.
Yes, yeah. I will quote, "I feel it is also important to have this, so to speak, magical element, not just in our lives generally, but especially in our spiritual lives. And it is symbol, myth, ritual, which helps give life this magical element, you might say also imaginative element in our lives, in our spiritual lives." Yes, so it's the same area of discussion. But you prefer to use the language of magic.
Yeah, but I don't know.
Yeah.
He was obviously banter doing it, whatever. But in that occasion, he just seemed to nail something.
Yeah. It, by the use of the term, you mean?
Yeah, I don't know why it was like that. Maybe for me, the idea of magic is something that I feel connected to, you know, in my past or whatever. It's hard to say. Just seem to.
Yeah. Well, I think you can think that that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
I'll every now and again try to remember to say magic.
Thank you.
So, if I can say a little bit more about magic. Yes, I think what I need to go on to... Oh, yes, there's one more thing that, particularly coming out of Coleridge, which I think is very, very interesting. It's imagination is unifying. It's unifying in the objective sense, in that brings the objects of experience together with meaning, if you see what I mean. So that it brings, it selects from the range of our experience elements that it are unified in meaning. But more interestingly, because I've already talked about that, more interestingly, it unifies the subject. Imaginative experience is a unity of the rational, the emotional, and also the sensory. So that in imaginative experience, you don't experience any hiatus between understanding, between reasoned understanding, and emotional impulse. You don't experience any conflict between your sensory experience and your emotional and intellectual life. They all come together. Image as sensory object, whether visionary or direct, whether mental or direct, image, emotion, and understanding or meaning are all unified. They're very, very interesting. Coleridge uses this term, unifying, and it's one possible reading of the word samadhi, which has something of the meaning of bringing together, unifying. And so that the experience of imagination is one of integration. When imagination is functioning, you feel whole. You do not feel divided. You do not feel conflict. Again, the most characteristic experience for many people is aesthetic. I find that's the easiest reference point. Perhaps you get that experience in meditation. But when you are really absorbed in a poem or a painting, a film, you're fully absorbed in it. You know what it's like after you've been engaged in a very strong aesthetic experience. You've listened to a beautiful piece of music, and somebody wants to analyse it immediately afterwards, and your soul revolts because it doesn't want to bifurcate, it doesn't want to divide. You want to stay with the integral experience that you're left with by the piece. So I think the function of imagination as unitary, unifying, is very, very characteristic and something we do experience. And of course it connects with meditation. And Bhante considers that dhyana is the experience of imagination. The mind unifies, it passes into a different state, which is best talked about from this point of view as a state of imagination. You become imagination. It's not something that sort of functions separate from you, it's what you are. So, one last topic, the most difficult of all, the ontology of imagination. Am I foolish or not? Do the objects of imagination exist or not? And if so, in what sense? Discuss. Think that in the Buddhist field, you have a very strong vision of the Buddha or of a Bodhisattva or whatever. So you need to ask, what is the ontological status of that image? In more traditional context, you have an experience of deities of various kinds. So what is their status? Do they really exist or not? When you see the nature as animate and you see a dryad or a nereid or whatever, does it really exist, a nature spirit? Are they really there or not? How are we to talk about the ontology of the imagination without veering into either sentimentality, investing with a meaning that they don't have or a reality they don't have, or into mere imagination, if you see what I mean, debasing imagination so that it becomes something mere entertainment or whatever? How are we to approach the existential quality of imagination? So I put this to Bhante, and he first of all invoked a notion that he'd tried on me before, which was a non-ontic existence. Don't think about it too hard. Dangerous things will happen. Anyway, apparently he'd read recently some Japanese commentator on Far Eastern thought, who was explicating an idea that is found in Chinese Buddhism, apparently, and then in Japanese Buddhism, which is two notions of existence. I don't think there are two words necessarily, but it's easy to understand existence in two senses. And so there's a sense of existence which is ontological, as having some concrete reality external to us. And there's a sense of a non-ontic existence, which is of a quite different kind. Anyway, I talked about all this with Saramati, who is a Chinese scholar and well-versed in Chinese thought, and he was very doubtful about it. So I decided to cross this out of my piece of writing, especially as I didn't make altogether good sense of it. Anyway, Bhante invoked another idea, which I think is much, much more useful. He invoked an idea that really goes back to Nietzsche, but that is worked out most fully by another German philosopher, Hans Waehinger. You may, those of you who studied Schopenhauer, may have come across him in that connection. He was a late Schopenhauerian. He was also quite strongly influenced by the British empiricists, Hume and Berkeley and so on. But he was puzzling over the issue of how it is that, taking Kant and Schopenhauer and Berkeley and Hume seriously, we can no longer really accept that we know reality. that we are in contact with a real world that's out there. We don't in a way know whether there is one or not. What we're experiencing are our own sense impressions, however generated. And you know, the way in which we talk about the way they're generated comes from within their generation, if you see what I mean. So we can't really get at it. So he's saying, well, how are we then to think about the objects of our experience? And he said that we should think of them as if they were really there. And he wrote a book called The Philosophy of As If, which apparently had was very popular, had a big influence on Adler, and I've recently discovered had a big influence on James Hillman. You remember he wrote the Myth of Analysis. And he meant myth in this sense, the as if of analysis. That it was the healing myth and this sort of thing. It's the healing myth that he wrote, wasn't it? So he meant myth in this sense. It's a usage that takes something as real, that in a sense is not real, but that is effective. This position Wittgenstein also took, he was quite strongly influenced by Weyhinger. You know, the early Wittgenstein offered a picture theory of meaning, that what we know, or rather the way of talking that we have, is a picture, a mirror, of what actually is. And later he realised the weakness of that. And he developed a theory of meaning which was much more to do it with its usefulness. The words we have, the ideas that we have, are to be judged by their effectiveness. Of course, that raises questions about effective for what. But cutting a long story short, Bante was saying that we should think of these objects of imagination as if they really exist. And he went on to say, well, actually, yes, Weyhinger is right. Everything only exists as if it existed. There are no external objects. There is no independent reality. There couldn't be. We know that. That's Buddhist philosophy's inconclusive demonstration. It can't exist independent of us, because how could we know it? In a way, everything exists in that sense, and we're training ourselves to see things as if they're real, they're void, yet appearing, appearing, yet void. So it's no different with the productions of imagination. They appear, but they have no substantial existence. And they're to be related to on the basis of their potential for our growth, our development, our realization. It's a very, very wonderful Golden Age play by Calderón de la Barca called La Vida es Sueño, Life is a Dream. A remarkable play. They're very interesting, those thinkers, artists like Cervantes and so forth. They were playing with this whole area of illusion and reality. That's what Don Quixote is about. But in La Vida es Sueño, a prince is several times put to sleep and put in a dungeon and then taken out of the prison and put in the palace and then put back in the dungeon. He doesn't know what's real and what's not real. Poor fellow. And if in the end, the conclusion of the whole play, he just decides, I don't know what's real and what's not. But what I will do is I will act well, as if it was real. So you could say, in a way, that's the underlying philosophy of Buddhism, that whatever the experience we have, relate to it on its own terms and relate to it skillfully, karmically skillfully. A friend just contacted me this morning and he'd a death of a close relative and had some experience of that relative in the middle of the night, a very strong experience. And in our discussions, I noticed we were both of us, because he's a good philosopher, both of us very careful not to discuss whether it really happened or not. It happened because that was his experience, if you see what I mean. And the main thing was how he related to it. I think that what Bhante is saying is, take everything as if it's real. Take it on its own terms, because nothing exists really in a substantial way. So it's just the same for the visions the same for our dreams. Take them seriously in their own right. Don't think that don't always try to relate the dream to your waking life. Sometimes it's better to relate your waking life to your dream, if you see what I mean. Your waking life is a better expression of your dream than the other way around.
Can I just check, is there a parallel to be drawn there with what you were saying earlier about the distinction between fantasy and imagination? So that some experiences might merely be a fantasy. A fantasy, something you would like to have. It's actually coming out of craving.
Yeah.
Which might not be so closely related on the basis of their own self.
Yes, except that, of course, what you need to learn to do is to relate to those in a skillful way, if you see what I mean, so that you learn to see the object that appears under the influence of your craving or your hatred. You learn to see it as it really is, if you see what I mean, so that even there, you don't start telling yourself, I shouldn't be experiencing that. That's a very difficult thing to tell yourself. But what you can tell yourself is, I can relate to that in a more skillful and positive way. I think it's fundamental in Buddhism that in a way you can't change the vipakas very directly, but you can change the karma. So that whatever the experience that comes to you, you try to relate to it in a skillful way. And as you relate to that experience in a skillful way, it will transform. So I think it's not. It might be a question of recognizing that the mode of operation of your mind is merely fancy, and trying to relate to that in a more skillful way, a more creative way. But I don't think it's a question of trying to decide what is real and what is not real. It's their epistemological. It's not their epistemological usefulness. It's their moral value that is to be judged. I think this is, in a way, what I take from Wittgenstein, that ultimately you must judge the truth or falsehood of things by their moral value. In Buddhism, there's no, you know, our epistemology teaches us that there is no really existent substance. So that frees us then to do the real business, which is the moral evaluation of karma. Mm.
I think there's a slight problem there in the sense that you're trying to transpose stuff from the East into a Western diction, because whilst I don't disagree with what you've actually said, I think that what you said was quite useful. Nevertheless, in the West, we have this long history of Western idealism, which slips the meaning between epistemology and ontology together. In other words, it goes on to kind of suggest that the real world doesn't actually exist.
Yeah.
And that's a disaster. That's something that Buddhism never really got.
Wait, I think that's why Bhante's invoking the Schopenhauerian tradition and Weyhinger, because they're definitely not idealists, if you see what I mean. But they're not realists either.
Sure.
So I think that there is a very clear connection between that way of thinking and Buddhist thinking on the philosophical front. But the main point for the present situation, I mean, I told you what Bhante referred to, the main point for the present situation is that we apply Buddhist ontology or an ontological deconstruction to imaginative experience. It's empty. It's devoid of Atman. But that's not different from anything else. So we have the same mindful approach to the productions of the imagination as we do to the productions of the ordinary sense organs. That's the point. I was using Bhante's invocation of Weyhinger just to make another connection.
I think the imaginal, in your sense of it, you could say Buddhist sense perhaps, is intrinsically ethical.
Yes,
I
think that's fair enough. But I suppose it's problematic because you know, you find yourself in the midst of a fantasy, or a fancy, if you see what I mean, which is the result of your previous actions. How do you now relate to that? Do you see what I mean? It's, once the image has arisen within your mind, it's not ethical or unethical. It's the motivations that have created it are the problem. So the issue is how you relate to it now.
Are they defined by their ethical nature?
Are what defined?
Fantasy and imagination.
Well, I suppose that in a way that they're defined. It's by the whole framework within which they've arisen. So fantasy, or fancy in Coleridge's sense, is merely mechanical productions of ordinary desires, if you sort of mean egoistic desires, whereas imagination is the production of something that goes beyond your conscious identity. So, and that has obviously a higher value from a Buddhist point of view. But you're in the midst of a fantasy. Don't waste time thinking about whether it's good or bad. Try to find a healthy way of relating to it.
Just putting some of these isms aside, seems to me a very basic way that people get conditioned to look in the West at reality is what you can see, what material exists.
Yes, yeah.
Everything else is just a product of your mind.
Yeah, spot on.
I think is what undermines a lot of our attempts at sadhana and meditative connection. There's a voice telling us this is all the product of your mind. It's just you making it up. Because that's such a strong disconnection.
Spot on. I think when the question is asked, do they exist or not, it presupposes a certain notion of existence, a common sense notion of existence, that you can feel it, touch it, take a photograph of it, and so on. I think that's right. And particularly,
we have to tackle that head on.
Yes, yeah.
For our farmers to work. And
yeah. That's why I was sort of saying that I think that it's not just a question of the ontology of the imagination, it's ontology itself. What is the nature of reality? Once you've grasped that there is no substantial independent existence, then the same principles apply to imagination as to our ordinary experience. Yes, so I think you're spot on. I think it's the materialist assumption that even highly religious people assume in the West today that is the issue. That's what really is being asked.
Sorry, I do want to come back to this issue about reality and imagination in the sense of...
To what?
Reality and imagination, the mental and the physical in terms of ethics.
Yeah.
Because I think it is very much an issue that if you go too far down the idea of reality being structured just by the mind, so to speak, you get into a very unethical state. So, for example,
indeed,
a man comes to you who's starving, and you say, oh no, it's just in your mind, mate.
Yeah,
You're not really starving.
Yeah.
It's just you have that
mess
of armour.
Although
we can laugh at that, that sort of thinking is not actually unknown, even in our movement. I remember some of the problems that we used to have in Windhorse. And used to go and talk to it was always a Mitchell, wasn't it? Mitchell would go and talk to an audience member. He said, there's a problem here. Where are you coming from with that? You know, we're better than this morning, And the poor old Mitchell wants to suggest an objective problem, It's psychologized as being a problem that they've got, rather than having...
I'm sure that can happen. Of course, it can be that there are psychological issues. So without wishing to debate, is prejudge what really happened in any particular situation. Yes, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I think that's a real danger of confusing the real world with a psychological world.
Well, there's the Buddhist versions of it. I don't know whether any of you read that book, Buddhism and Warfare.
Sure.
It's really quite horrifying, the way in which the notion of shunyata is misapplied. So that, it's actually Arjuna's argument in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna's argument to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, that it doesn't matter if you kill people because it's all Maya anyway. So you get versions of that essentially nihilistic eternalism, strange. Yeah.
Isn't this highlighting the importance of being able to make a relative distinction between relatively real and relatively unreal?
Hmm. Yeah.
There's a separate distinction.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. To
yeah. 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 Well, I didn't do much on it, but I deliberately wrote this paper after writing the previous paper on right view. It seemed to me that it's one of the things that we need to get very clear. We need to be able to distinguish what we're doing when we talk, if you see what I mean. When you're talking philosophy, you need to be rigorously Madhyamaka, if you like, rigorously, well, basic Buddhism, anicca, anatman, and so forth. And I think we need a much clearer recognition of the nature of right view in this sense. Once you've got that clear, you can use most wonderful imaginative philosophy, and this is where things like Gandavyuha Sutra come in. You can use that once you're clear about what you're doing. You're using what I've called poetic philosophy rather than analytic philosophy or ontology. So that I think there's a way of thinking that is supportive of imagination, if you see what I mean. But it's very easy for that to be pseudo-ontologized, if you see what I mean, because it necessarily has to use a quasi-ontological language. Because in order to speak, you have to use a kind of implicit ontology. So I do think that we need to get clear about pratitya-samuppada, fundamentally, and be able to be clear that when we're talking in the realm of imagination, we're talking as if. And I think that needs to be quite strongly represented in our rhetoric from time to time, that it needs to be constantly touched down on as if. Or it needs to be quite clear that what you're doing is being absolutely rigorous. And there are times when you need to keep yourself in a very tight leash and you know, not allow yourself to snap either at eternalism or at nihilism and to stick rigorously to the language of pratitya-samuppada, etc. And there are times when you know that there's a common framework of philosophical understanding, if you like, not necessarily sophisticated, where you can talk imaginatively. You can let yourself off the leash. So I'm hoping that we're in that territory. But so yes, this is the ontology of imagination is no different from the ontology of so-called ordinary experience. And once we've got that clear, we can just allow ourselves to let rip, so to speak. You know, Bhante famously was asked by somebody, what happens if you feel like praying to Tara? And he said something like, well, do the praying and then worry about the theology later. In other words, let yourself go imaginatively, as you do in a dream. You know, in a dream, you're not always saying, I got my fingers crossed, I don't really believe this. When you watch a film, you enter into the world of the film fully without sort of constantly telling yourself, Parche, Brecht and all that. So you deliberately allow your imagination full rein. But you know it's not real in the end, although you have real emotions in relation to it. So it's a very important critical distinction. I think that Buddhism is utterly brilliant at clarifying with the utmost rigour what the limits of the knowable, the limits of the sayable, but not confining us to that and allowing us to launch into the depths of things imaginatively and ultimately in realisation. I think this is what is so different about Buddhism. I've been thinking about this a lot in relation to God. I've been thinking about God, and God's been speaking to me. I'm sort of semi-serious. I'll make my full revelation later, but I am the Son. No. I think one of the problems we have is that those of us from the West, even those of us not brought up as Christians, we come from a world, a culture that is built up around a belief in God. And that belief in God started to be eroded and a language developed which was bereft of God. But it's largely, as it were, a God-shaped universe without God in it. It's the material part of things without the God in it. And I think we as Buddhists have a big trouble to allow the space that was filled by God to be filled by something that's not God. It's very difficult to talk about. I'll say a little bit more about this before I take your question, but I'll see you're there. Can you wait a minute? Let me just say a little bit more, because I'm touching on something that requires more exposition. So, I've come these days not to do what I've always done in the past, which is when somebody says there is a God, say, no, there isn't. They say, yes, there is. And I say, no, there isn't. But I'd use the language more like, in Buddhism, we don't speak about it in that way. So you're not denying what may be an experience with which you can identify, or that may be related to the areas you want to go into. The problem is the idea, or the experience, if it is an experience, has become fitted into a theological and cultural framework that often is not very helpful, and indeed can lead to the utmost unskillfulness. So I felt that this whole realm of imagination, we need to dare to look at God. I'm not suggesting that we have a God in Buddhism, but that the experience that many people will label God is not an experience that is alien to Buddhism. And that we need to tread a delicate line between buying into that theological perspective on the one hand and denying it on the other. And I know myself in the past, I've loved to tweak the noses of theists in one way or another. It can be a great sport. Actually, it's all to do with me, isn't it? It's to do with my own complicated relationship with that space which is bound to be there as a Westerner, and how I'm going to deal with that. So Bhante, you noticed from the previous paper, those of you who've read it or remember it, I quoted Bhante as saying that he thought that we should dare to think of the Buddha as the Buddhist God. But he's a God who did not create the universe and who is not the administrator of cosmic justice. Which leaves not a lot left. he said that it's very interesting, in Thailand, when Buddhism went to Thailand, they couldn't find a word for God. So the word for God today, and I've confirmed this with Thai Christians, is the Buddha who created the universe. So he said we sort of almost need to do the same thing. We can't exactly do it, but we need to kind of be conscious of the same process. That there are things about God that are definitely not on. We can't believe in a creator. We don't need an arbiter of the moral order, because karma does that. It's built in. It's inherent. It's a natural process, if you like. But there's something that God does that the Buddha does, which is represent or embody the highest goal, ideal, highest reality, to use that term non-philosophically, that there is. So I think this is part of what we need to get sort of tease our way into and round without ending up claiming that there's a God. The Buddha does need to sort of occupy that space. And confession time. I found that since talking to Bhante about this, I've been sort of allowing something to come back into my life that was there much earlier on. Although I was brought up as a Christian and rejected Christianity, what I rejected was really my mother, poor girl, and the whole sort of public school, middle class ethos which went with it, a whole kind of early 20th century model of what a gentleman was. That was what, because God really at that time was still the Tory party at prayer. The Church of England, sorry, was the Tory party at prayer. So for me it was sort of to do with a finding of myself and so on. But with that something that was a real experience for me went too. And at that time, I just assumed that was God. There was it's really hard to put a name on it or a word to it. What do I call it? A sense of something within my own experience which is way beyond me and that's highly, well, the most desirable thing there can possibly be. Thinking over what Bhante said, well, I find actually that's the Buddha. It's focused for me now around my reading of the Pali Canon, around my Manjushri practice, around my bowing in front of the murti, the image. But there's a sense within my own mind of a dimension which is not mine, which is beyond me. It must be beyond me. I want it to be beyond me because it would be too small if it was me. But that I previously had identified with God. There's lightning going to strike. So I think this is an area that in this discussion of imagination, in this discussion of the reawakening of the West, if you like, and the reimagining of the Buddha within the context of the West, we need to find a way of moving into, which does not lead us back into superstition and
it's happening.
Yes. There are some things you can't override. Is the overriding a long process or touching of that? Okay. It's sort of a bit too delicate a point to stop, so we need another 5 minutes maybe. He switched off the heat, but got the blower. Anyway, it's probably enough. I can hear myself think. Yeah. Better sadhu, what are you?
I don't want to anticipate what you might say later.
Good.
When you listed public school, the gentlemen are, and the Tory party at prayer.
Yeah.
I encapsulated that as the word culture. That's Subhuti's culture.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
And I've got my culture, which is a bit different.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about the role of culture in relation to the system that you described earlier as to animism, aesthetics.
Yes, I'm not going to tackle it head on, but it will be indirectly discussed, yeah.
It seems to me that
word
is in the way, isn't it?
You could say that, yeah. But I think that although I was talking about just a take back to the indirectly we will talk about what you're interested in, I think, and there will certainly be a point for you to take off if it still arises, but I think that the issues that I'm talking about probably affect everybody, whether you went to a public school and were brought up as a gentleman or not, which I can see many of you are not. Yeah, I think that the issue of God, at least, is inherent in the whole structure of Western society.
But isn't the broader thing that actually to move from God to enlightenment?
Yes. There needs to be a change in culture.
It's ma-
brings yeah.
a whole mix of different cultural...
Yes, yeah. But there are broad, broad underlying patterns, I think, that we can concur on. But we need to do a lot of exploration down many different lines. But yes, it seems to me that we're at the very, very beginnings of building a Buddhist culture. And I hope that even these hours are a contribution towards. They're certainly not the last word, though I'd love to have it. They're not the last word. And I think that we are venturing upon something that we will not live to see. We may live to see next time. But we're building something quite different. We're building a reanimated world. We're building a world in which sensibility is part of our common discourse. And we're building a world in which the Buddha is alive, or Bodhi is alive. We will not live to see that as a common cultural experience. We'll have flashes of it. We may have experiences of it ourselves. But we're needing to build that in the midst of a larger society. So in dialogue with that larger society, within us and outside us. So culture is the issue. We're trying to build a culture which reanimates imagination in the context of the Buddha Dhamma.
Says it can't be done.
Ah.
Why do you think it can be done?
My own reading of Jung, what Jung has to say about Buddhism, is that he really didn't understand it. And there's a very good analysis of one aspect of that in John Merthyn Reynolds' introduction to the seeing of reality and naked awareness. It's a very, very good piece of deconstruction. It just shows how, you know, Jung was talking about a phenomenon that undoubtedly he was right about, but it wasn't Buddhism. It wasn't what it was partly Evans Wentz's misreading of the text and partly Jung's misreading of that misreading. So Jung didn't understand. I think that's the basic issue, and he had a very strong I can't say so much about this, I've not read or studied so much about it, but my impression reading Jung is that he has an over attachment to the distinctiveness of the West from the East. I don't think it's so thoroughly distinct. However, I think there is something in what he says. And in a way, part of what I'm saying is that having applied Buddhist ontology to our experience, we need to recreate the way in which we talk about our unfolding spiritual experience in the light of our Western culture, and an increasingly global culture as well. So I think he was right to that extent. It's difficult, it can work for some. It's difficult to take mythological frameworks from different cultures and work them out for ourselves. And by and large, what we do is actually recreate them in terms of our own culture. This is what Said was talking about in terms of Orientalism, wasn't he? That our fascination with the Orient is actually fascination with our own creation. I think that Jung was right to that extent, and this is really, in a sense, part of what I'm trying to get at, that we need to come at the Buddhist perspective, the Buddha's Dhamma, which is a perspective of Pratitya Samuppada. There is nothing fixed. The perspective that there is a karmic order and a dhammic order. That's the most important thing. And apply that within our own unfolding experience. So experiences will come to us that we don't need to refer necessarily to any traditional Buddhist culture. We need to keep in mind basic Buddhist dharma, but we need to read those afresh. And that needs to be informed by the whole cultural history, both in a cautionary sense and in an advantageous sense. And God, I think, is the big ghost in the... not ghost in the machine, ghost at the table. He's sort of sitting there, and I think somehow now that we need to take him on without taking him on. If you see what I mean. We need to take something on that is represented by that. This is clearly what Tathagatagarbha is all about. But there are problems with that because it crosses the boundaries of poetic and analytic philosophy. And often taken in a very sentimental way. But we need to find a way of talking that deals with the experience that genuinely has touched St. John of the Cross and Meister Eckhart and so forth, without adopting the problems that are inherent in that philosophy and theology. And I think that one of the... an unbelievable optimist. I believe that Buddhism offers the best chance for Western culture to renew itself, because it frees itself from the dichotomies, the dualities that are bred into the system of the West. Liberates the energy that there is, the huge energy there is in this culture. One of the most sophisticated, complex and rich cultures the world has ever known. I mean, not in the scientific sense merely, but in the imaginative, aesthetic sense.